Okay, thank you very much. So yesterday we considered the first part of the saga, the least controversial one, as you could appreciate, the origin of eukaryotes. And today we make a huge jump back, and we'll discuss what potentially is the most controversial part of the trilogy, namely the very beginnings and how particular models of cosmology, particular view of the universe and its origin and history that people hold may affect our ideas on the origin of life. In his talk, Andreas, I think very convincingly, I agree on even on independent grounds with that conclusion, showed that there is no such thing as, so far, as non-trivial network biology. So sort of follow step and we'll try to show that there is no such non-trivial problem as the origin of life. Okay. In particular, we'll discuss some very special model of the world called eternal inflation and how it affects our notions of the transition from chance to biological evolution in the history of life. As this introductory slide, I couldn't resist the temptation to put here George Gamow, a very remarkable American scientist of Russian extraction, who happened to make very, very substantial contributions both to the to the ideas on the origin of the seconds of the existence of the universe and the genesis of the chemical elements and so on, pretty much was one of the founders of the Big Bang, standard Big Bang model. And he also, towards the end of his career, made very important contributions to the very concept of the genetic code. And he also was a very remarkable man. Does anyone know why the cow is here? No? In addition to publishing seminal papers on the Big Bang and on the genetic code, Gamow once submitted in full seriousness a manuscript to Nature with a theory explaining why cows supposedly chew clockwise in the northern hemisphere and counterclockwise in the southern hemisphere. Put there some equations containing the Coriolis force that claim to explain this. As it happens to all of us sometimes, very unfairly, Nature rejected that manuscript, but it has become famous anyway. In any case, I think even he did not really connect these two strands of his scientific life. But we now will try to do so. Since we all know now that what happens here with most talks, and since many of us would have a very understandable urge to eat lunch, I will now just present in one slide the message in a nutshell, so to speak. It is actually simple, and I hope it, I just earnestly hope it is outrageous. The origin of life is a typical chicken and egg problem, a catch-22, so to speak. In order for the biological evolution to start, and as Andreas pointed out absolutely correctly in his talk, the real distinguishing feature of life is biological evolution. For that process to start, efficient systems for replication and translation are required. But these systems, as we shall have a chance to see, are themselves staggeringly complex and appear to be products of extensive selective evolution. There is no solution to that chicken and egg problem per se, but the standard partial solution that is very often considered, and I think the veterans of this program who were here in January had the opportunity to see and hear some great talks on that subject. The standard partial solution that is most of the time considered is the so-called RNA world model, whereby a stage in the evolution of life, or prebiological evolution is envisaged, where replication was catalyzed by ribozymes, there were no proteins, at least no biogenic proteins, and from which the translation system somehow emerged. The RNA world, as I will show in part, also is a very interesting and important concept, is buttressed by a variety of experiments on ribozymes, but at the same time, the reality of it or the feasibility of it has never really been demonstrated, less so the path to translation from the RNA world. Enter cosmological models. I'll introduce a particular one that stems from the fairly well-accepted notion of cosmic inflation and proceeds towards the idea of eternal inflation, that is, that the exponential expansion of the universe pretty much goes forever, and we shall discuss briefly how universes emerge in that infinite sea of eternal inflation. And I'll argue that this worldview offers a viable alternative to the notions like RNA world, given that all macroscopic histories that are permitted by the laws of physics are inferred to be repeated an infinite number of times in the infinite universe. This very dramatically expands the range of possibilities for the crucial transition from chance to biological evolution in the history of life. That is, complex systems not only can, but they inevitably emerged by chance. And therefore, something as complex as a coupled system of replication and translation, in principle, very well could have been the starting point of biological evolution. Hence, no RNA world in the sense usually understood in terms of self-replication, of extensive self-replication of RNAs, although there is still a key role of RNA in the origin of life, of course. However improbable, or more precisely in the context of the infinite universe, rare the emergence of such complex systems might be, its occurrence in our own universe could very well be made inevitable by entropic selection. Okay, so basically the original installment of this talk was geared to physicists, mostly. Inevitably, a seminar like this faces a mixed audience, and this is of physicists, cosmologists, and biologists, and this is truly great, but it also poses a challenge. So originally I sort of geared this talk to physicists, and therefore we have a very, I'll pretty much rush through a very quick introduction to the complexity of biological information transfer pathways. Yes. You see, I'll introduce that very, it's probably actually familiar to most of the people in the audience, but I'll introduce that towards the middle of my talk in explicit terms. So let's just wait until then. All right. I'll briefly just illustrate to you, or remind you, dramatic complexity of pathways for biological information transfer. So this figure comes directly from the famous 1970 paper of Francis Crick about the central dogma of molecular biology, and very nicely illustrates different ways of information transfer that occur in biological systems. With the exception apparently of this arrow, all this is real, all this indeed happens in various circumstances. As Crick itself very prophetically indicated, this whole scheme was intended to apply only to present-day organisms and not to the event in the remote past, such as the origin of life or the origin of the code. So right away, we'll simplify the problem to some extent by considering only the lower part of this scheme, which, as it should be clear, and as I will discuss more, should be sufficient to kick off biological evolution. It's hard enough with this only, without considering the involvement of DNA. So, regarding the staggering complexity, even the simplest replication systems that we are aware of require very specific, exquisitely fitted RNA structures, and as well as several proteins that are produced by the extremely complex translation system. It's reasonable to assume, it's plain clear, that the simplest replication system are found in RNA viruses, in particular in single-stranded plus-strand RNA viruses, and these the replication cycles of different RNA viruses are schematically illustrated on this slide. Basically, you have a strand of RNA, then there is translation, and the whole translation system is involved in this. As a result of this translation, you produce a virus-specific subunit of the RNA polymerase. That virus-specific subunit interacts with some proteins in the host cell, and these proteins together in concert catalyze the replication of this genome. So the genome carries on the information for its own replication, and in order to realize that information on top of it, it interacts in complex ways with the translation system. So the translation system is really a remarkably complicated affair. That is by now fairly well understood, although by no means completely. So what does it entail? In terms of a simple abridged list of components, at least three large ribosomal RNAs, about 50 ribosomal proteins that associate with those RNAs in two ribosomal subunits, about 30 specific tRNA molecules, about 20 large enzymes, amino acid tRNA synthetases that are essential for the genetic code to work, about 10, a very simplified estimate, about 10 translation factors, about 20. Again, a very modest estimate, RNA modification enzymes. You can easily see that this is more than 100 complex RNA and protein components that are assembled in a very remarkable structures. I will show you a couple of schemes of the elongation of translation and termination of translation. Just to remind you, a feeling for the choreography, so to speak, of the translation system, which accepts the machine of translation, of course, the ribosome, and it accommodates an mRNA, and then tRNAs are specifically delivered to the mRNA with the help of translation factors, which are enzymes, GTPases themselves, that hydrolyze GTP, which facilitates their own release, and then the ribosome does most of the job by by allowing coordinated movements of these tRNAs and the concomitant formation of peptides. And even more complex processes with additional translation factors are required for translation termination, and I'm not even showing you a similar schematic for the initiation of translation. That would involve even more steps and even more proteins. In remarkable achievements within the last few years, three-dimensional structures of the ribosomal subunits have been resolved, and you can see some of those structures right there. This is, if you look here, this yellowish, largely, object is the large 50S subunit, and this bluish object is the smaller 30S subunits. And what you see here is a precise arrangement of long RNA molecules associated with a variety of proteins. You can see, if you are used to look at structures, you can see various ribosomal proteins stuck here in specific places on the RNA. The genetic code itself, we are of course all very familiar with this table. What I would like to emphasize is that it's not just a specific correspondence between sets of nucleotide triplets and amino acids. It's a very finely structured table, such as the third letter is partially redundant, and because of that and because of other aspects of the organization of this table, the code is highly robust to mutational and translational errors. The degree of code's optimality has been debated, but in this very well known paper of Freeland and Hurst, it has been claimed that the genetic code is one in a million. So if you make a million, or if you sample a million random codes, you are expected to find one with robustness like this or greater. Other people gave even more impressive numbers. So what makes the code work? The table that we have seen is in a certain sense dead. It's just the rule of correspondence between nucleotide triplets and amino acids. What makes it work? What makes it work in modern translation systems are these very large enzymes that in this textbook scheme are shown by this greenish irregular shape called amino acid tRNA synthetases. And what they do is is ensuring the specific binding of amino acids to the so-called cognate tRNAs, that is, to the tRNAs that contain the appropriate nucleotide triplet, the anticodon. The amino acid does not, in it by itself, in modern translation systems, recognize the cognate tRNAs. The enzyme specific for each amino acid recognizes both and ensures the correct charging of tRNA. So I would claim that the origin of replication and translation, and in an homage to our astronomical colleagues, I call it ORT for short, is in a certain sense the mother of all problems in biology. I would say the hardest problem in evolutionary biology and probably in biology in general. On the surface of it, it is a typical classical Darwinian problem. How can complex systems that superficially may look, quote unquote, irreducibly complex evolve via natural selection? This takes us back to Darwin's very famous discussion of the evolution of the animal eye in the origin of species, and Darwin very ingeniously showed how such a complex organ might have and would have evolved through numerous slight modifications, starting from modest beginnings. A significant addition made by Stephen Jay Gould and Dick Levontin was the possibility of exaptation of so-called spandrels, evolutionary byproducts for new function. All that is good and well, and at least in principle can explain the evolution of the eye, of the blood clotting system and whatnot that is touted as cases of irreducible complexity. However, all this does not apply, at least by no means easily, to the origin of replication and translation, simply because for all these things to happen, those systems should have existed, whereas they did not. The conditio sine qua non for biological evolution to occur, and prior to their origin, these conditions did not exist. Okay. If and I'll actually discuss. That is good. That is good. But there are two big problems, as I will discuss specifically in a few moments. One big problem is that we really have no assurance that there could have been an RNA world. We have lots of nice experiments with ribozymes, but they don't really, in full honesty, take us to the RNA world. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that, suppose the problem number one has been solved somehow. There was an RNA world. What would be the incentive for translation system to emerge in such RNA world? I will discuss our best guesses on this subject in a few minutes. But I will tell you, I don't mind telling you right away that all our schematics that we show for possible pathways of such origin remind me too much of a Rube Goldberg machine cartoon. I don't like them very much. I'll show you.
So, yeah. But it's generally conceivable that in some prebiotic, pre-translation state, there were replicating entities that had peptides inside, and that there were some processes that might help catalyze the production of these peptides. And you can imagine rigging yourself up from some modest beginning there too. Something that
you're going
to make more and more elaborate.
That is all really nice in principle, and I'll show you a specific scenario of this kind of bootstrapping or ratcheting or whatever you call it. As I say, there are so many steps in this scenario, getting ahead of myself, so many steps in this scenario that require unknown reactions, unknown and not very well justified processes, that I at least feel very uneasy about those scenarios. But we try. We try our very best. And I'm not saying it is impossible, all capitals. Of course not. Okay. So, generally, we have to keep in mind how biological complexity may end, for that matter, does increase in the process of evolution. After David Penny, I call this the Darwin Eigen cycle, whereby once you have, by some beneficial mutations, let's say, increased fidelity of replication, you then by drift can afford an increased size of your genome. And once you afford an increased size of your genome, you can evolve new functions in those new parts of the genome that are not subject to strong selection. Some of these new functions will allow you to increase your replication fidelity even further, and on you go until you get something as complex as, say, multicellular animals. This was, in general, terms imagined by Charles Darwin and developed in a nice quantitative theory by Manfred Eigen. The problem is, as I see it at least, how we actually do get on that merry-go-round. And I think there are substantial paradoxes here. Namely, to attain the minimal complexity required for a biological system to start on the path of biological evolution, a system of a far greater complexity, if we look at the modern known biological system, a system of a far greater complexity, highly evolved coupled system of replication and translation, seems to be required. Furthermore, high translation fidelity is not achievable without a complex, highly evolved set of RNAs and proteins, and such a machinery, of course, could not evolve without an advanced translation system. So I would claim that it's effectively impossible to develop a reasonable scenario for the origin of replication and translation without considering some evolutionary predecessors that would be qualitatively different from the modern systems. And such a solution, as we already started discussing, has been proposed in the RNA world, which I will define once again such that they are clear what we mean by an RNA world, as a diverse population of RNA molecules with numerous RNA enzymes, that is, ribozymes, including, in particular and most importantly, replicases capable of replicating other RNAs with an accuracy exceeding what I call the Eigen threshold or Eigen limit. I will explain what that means in a second. The crucial point here, once again, is that we do not need just many ribozymes, but we need effective protein or protein-less RNA-catalyzed replication. So, of course, many people realized that and examined the problem experimentally. In particular, this very claim starts the abstract of the classic paper from David Bartel's lab on this very subject. And sure enough, ribozymes capable of nucleotide polymerization have been selected in vitro. And we can take a look at them. These are, to my knowledge, the best ones. So you can see that they're fairly complex RNA molecules of something a little greater than, say, 100 nucleotides that possess this kind of central cavity. There they can accommodate this construct that, of course, has to be this substrate, that, of course, has to be prepared separately, which contains this template strand, which contains this primer annealed to the template strand. And once you give them that substrate in sufficient quantities, they are capable at rather painfully slow rate of extending that primer by about 15 nucleotides at most. Now, of course, all this has been done in the space of a few years, in very good labs, though, by specific design and selection of those ribozymes. These labs did not have the luxury of millions of years of evolution. Sorry about that. That apart, however, we have to plainly admit that the ribozymes for which the ability to catalyze nucleotide polymerization so far fall short, very short, of the requirements for efficient RNA replicases that must have functioned for the RNA world to be reality. Now, the second, as I said, this is the first big problem. The second big problem is, supposing this is solved somehow, how would translation system spring from the RNA world? What would be, more specifically, the selective force behind it evolution before it could produce proteins? Well, in general terms, the only solution one can think of is the translation evolved by the route of adaptation. The original selection was for some sort of another distinct function. The concept of adaptation, it's an important evolutionary concept proposed by Stephen Jay Gould a long time ago, whereby some biological entity evolves either to perform a specific function that is, however, different from what it does nowadays. Say translation, just as a matter of, you know, toy example, we now have a translation system that makes proteins on an RNA template. At best we can judge, we cannot see the incentive for such a thing to emerge before there were proteins. We hit a paradox. So the solution to that paradox is adaptation. That is, it evolved because it performed some other function. Let's say RNA replication, just for example. But I'll argue for something different, actually. If there is such a possibility, I'll argue for something different. Before I actually start presenting those scenarios, I want to malign the RNA world a little bit more by indicating that it seems like only limited complexity, at the best, would be attainable in an RNA world with the replication fidelities they can think of, because it really doesn't stand to reason that the replication fidelity in the RNA world would be greater than that of the simplest modern protein polymerases. That is to the tune of 10 to the minus 3 errors per nucleotide. If reasonably RNA replicates are about an order of magnitude less accurate, the threshold value follows easily from eigen theory. Roughly, it should be the reciprocal of the genome size. If you are significantly below that, there will be an error catastrophe. So it seems like, at best, very limited genomes of very limited complexity on the order of 100 nucleotides could evolve and thrive in the RNA world if it existed. Okay, now we will come to this bootstrapping or ratcheting part or whatever. Most painfully honed ideas on how the translation system and coding actually could evolve from within the RNA world. So this picture shows my collaborator in this business and in many other studies, Yuri Wolf, and even from here you can see that this is really not easy to think specifically about those issues. He's a very fit man, but he's not in good shape here. The key assumption that we use here is indeed a fully fledged RNA world. Suppose by hook or crook that problem has been solved. RNA catalyzed replication works well. So I'll introduce something important right away into this line of discussion by indicating that through very simple stereochemical modeling, it becomes clear that direct translation of RNA by interaction of amino acids with triplets is just not possible. The amino acids simply will be too far from each other to allow any kind of peptide formation. So, adapters, something like tRNAs or something like tRNAs, must have been part of the story from the very beginning. Okay. The next set of slides is really meant for illustration of how this might work. I would not dwell on the details, because if I do, we really do not come to the end. It just is used to illustrate the possibilities and the problems. So, effectively, as I said, the only possibility I can think of, at least, for the translation system to evolve from the RNA world is exaptation. So, the central idea is that translation evolved as a, so to speak, collateral of stimulation of ribozymes by amino acids and peptides. A very similar idea has been briefly discussed by Harry Noller a couple of years ago. This is, by the way, experimentally feasible. There are ribozymes whose activity is stimulated by amino acids and peptides. So suppose we start with a ribozyme that catalyzes a particular reaction. That could be pretty much anything at all. So the crucial thing now is that this ribozyme interacts with amino acids, and hopefully with a couple of abiogenic amino acids which bind to it and enhance the reaction. Now, the next supposition is that somehow, by mutation, by chance, a peptide ligase activity evolves in this ribozyme, such that amino acids are linked by a peptide bond or become a dipeptide, which is supposed to be a better activator of the ribozyme. A decay of such a peptide-bound ribozyme would yield the peptide into the environment, whatever that was, and in principle could allow that peptide to be recruited by another ribozyme and stimulate its activity as well. What would happen next is known in modern evolutionary biology, when we consider duplications for the work of Mike Lynch and others, as subfunctionalization. Namely, after a duplication, one version of this ribozyme retains the original catalytic activity, whereas the other one loses the original catalytic activity and retains the peptide ligase activity. All this, of course, can only function in the context of some sort of ensemble of selfish cooperators, in the context of some kind of group selection, whereby there is some sort of primitive quote-unquote organism consisting of several such RNA molecules that enhance each other's survival and replication. Now, as I said, some sort of adapters must have been part of the story from the very beginning. How could those evolve? What we imagine is that in this context of ribozymes stimulated by peptides, and supposedly there were several of such at least, amino acids become a useful commodity, and that would allow the evolution of small RNAs that would recognize amino acids and originally function in terms of accumulation of amino acids in whatever compartments existed at that stage of evolution. The next, remember there were no proteins, so the next crucial step would be the evolution of autocatalytic amino acylation reaction in this kind of specific RNAs. Now, in principle, such RNA amino acid complexes could provide a better mode of delivery of amino acids to a peptide, to a ribozyme, whose activity is stimulated by peptides. So the further step on the evolution of such complexity would involve the arrival of two such RNAs to this ribozyme, formation of a complex between two such RNAs and such ribozyme, and a more efficient formation of the stimulating peptide. Those familiar with the ribosomal cycle would notice that this kind of ribozyme would be an evolutionary precursor of the large ribosomal subunit. Okay. The next required step would be evolution of accessory additional RNA subunit, which would facilitate binding and positioning of this RNA, small RNA amino acid complex on the large subunit. One could postulate that this additional RNA subunit contains a strand complementary to triplets, the future anticodons present in those molecules. So that would be the prototype of the small ribosomal subunit. Then one could imagine that there would be mutant forms of this proto-small subunit that would bind different species of amino acid charged RNAs, and eventually they would somehow learn to accept exogenous RNAs, basically prototypes of mRNAs. This, I think, starts resembling the process of translation. And then, of course, all the complex molecular movements that are currently catalyzed by ribosomes, primarily we will note by RNA in the ribosomes, should have evolved. So at this stage, the breakthrough would occur. The primitive, simple, but functioning translation system would potentially exist. Now, do you like this? Well, personally, I like this better than nothing, better than no scenarios at all, but honestly, not very much. And with all the knowledge of the literature, I have not noticed any more convincing attempts. There are many interesting possibilities here. There are ribozymes, there are stimulation of ribozymes with amino acids and peptides. All this is good as well, but I think there is rather, this is still pretty far-fetched. There is little real progress, and many processes that we are unaware of are postulated. I'm not saying that any of this is impossible, but what I am saying indeed is that alternatives, if any, even if some radical ones, need to be taken seriously. And here, we switch gears completely. And at the ungodly lunch hour, talking about the models of global features of our universe. Some very crucial observational features of that universe, of our universe, its spatial flatness, the uniformity, homogeneity of cosmic microwave background radiation, and but also the amplitude of microwave background radiation variation, the deficit of magnetic monopoles, crucial features appear quite enigmatic under the standard Big Bang cosmology of the kind pioneered by Gamow, but are readily explained by the process called inflation. This being a period of initial exponentially fast expansion of the universe caused by repulsive gravity of false vacuum. That's basically the famous and partly infamous cosmological constant. As first proposed in this, in a clear form, first proposed by Alan Guth in this famous paper some 25 years ago. Now, the original Guth's original proposal was nice and exciting because it explained fairly naturally all these important observations, but it had the very difficult so-called graceful exit problem. That is, how would, it didn't really explain how inflation would end. And actually, Guth's paper contains a very curious phrase to the effect that he's publishing this in the hope that someone would come up with a solution. And of course, people did. Basically, without having any opportunity to get into the details of this, the solution is as striking as it is simple. And that's eternal inflation. That basically, inflation does not end. Once it's started, it goes on and will go on forever. As explained in this nice quote, in my opinion, nice quote from Alex Vilenkin, where false vacuum regions multiply much faster than they decay, and this means that inflation never ends in the entire universe, and the volume on the inflating regions keep growing without bound. So this is a schematic, a slightly modified schematic of the master universe, or multiverse, as it's often called, taken from Alex Vilenkin book. We are right now, or basically here, in one of these bubble universe that emerge in this sea of eternal inflation by occasional decay of small pieces of false vacuum with the formation of the true low energy vacuum. So, as Alex Vilenkin said in another paper, bubbles with different properties nucleate and expand in the inflating high energy background. We live in one of the bubbles and can observe only a tiny part of it. Sort of like that, only much, much faster. So the remarkable thing is that the infinities multiply. Each island universe is infinite from the point of view of its inhabitants. And you're here. We're here. In one of these small observable regions of which each island universe is inferred to contain an infinite number. It's the Big Bang here is represented in a way very different from the traditional form where it looks like a mysterious singularity. Rather, here it looks like the end of eternal inflation in this part, or local end for to the inflation and beginning of our local time. This is basically what happened 13 billion years ago or so in my first slide. Well, I hope you find all this fairly trivial, because what comes is somewhat more mind-boggling. I would like to introduce Alex Vilenkin from Tufts University, one of the leading cosmologists, at least in that train of thinking, in his charming popular book entitled Many Worlds in One. I really very strongly recommend this. Not that I take my understanding of these things from popular books, not really, but this is just about the most stimulating reading you can think of. So the key statement from which the title of the book comes, that is combined with eternal inflation and all of that, is that remarkably the number of all possible macroscopic histories that can be realized in an observable region of the universe is an unbelievably vast number like this, but importantly a finite number. That is basically a fairly straightforward Valentin and colleagues present a proof, but basically in simple terms it's a rather straightforward corollary of the uncertainty principle. So now we can easily figure out that the number of times a particular history is repeated in an infinite island universe is calculated like this. Since the number of regions is infinite and the number of histories is finite, the number of times each history, each unique history, is repeated is infinite. To quote again, each history permitted by laws of physics is repeated an infinite number of times in any infinite island universe. Now we come to the issue of entropic selection. Because these are two independent trains of thinking, this many worlds in one concept and entropic principle. But I think they converge very naturally and very neatly. According to the entropic principle, the only reason our observable region of the universe has its specific parameters is that otherwise we would not be here to discuss the fates of the universe. In other words, there is in principle lots of freedom in selecting the various parameters of the universe, but there are only that many possibilities that would allow existence of life and complex life in particular. Under the model that I just introduced to you, entropic selection is can be interpreted in a very straightforward way, such that basically the parameters of our observable region are selected among the vast number of parameter sets that exist in the universe, each in an infinite number of copies, by virtue of being conducive to the emergence and sustenance of life. That is, they all exist, but, so to speak, for the evolution of life, only certain ones have to be selected. The word selection does not exactly have the same meaning as in natural selection, but nevertheless, it's a selection from a vast ensemble of possibilities. This is dim, but maybe it's appropriate. You can see the shape of the plot. Anyway, it comes from the very nice little paper by Mario Livio and Sir Martin Rees on the entropic selection, and illustrates a simple thing. This is a plane bounded by the amplitude of cosmic microwave background radiation Q and the cosmological constant delta. And it's only, the plot should have been bigger in reality. It's only a small section of this two-dimensional plot where the values of the two parameters fit in such a way that in principle emergence of life would be possible. If there is too little fluctuation of the microwave background, for example, there would be no clumping of matter, there would be no galaxies, and so on. If, on the other hand, the landscape is too rough, the inhomogeneity is too high, there would be way too much clumping. Only we would basically see, we wouldn't see anything, but there would be basically only black holes. So the biophilic domain, so to speak, is a small subset of different combinations of parameters. Have I explained what entropic selection is effectively? Okay. The important thing to emphasize here in this whole story that I'm trying to tell is that I'm not really trying to give you a philosophical talk. Not at all. Philosophical implications may exist, but this is not what I'm trying to do. This many world in one concept is a straightforward implication of eternal inflation and is meant to be the straightforward depiction of the physical structure of the world. That is okay. In a certain sense, I'll come to that. I will come to a possible feedback. Of course, this is not easy. But the way I see it is this. We gain belief in theoretical implications that are not observable if they follow in a relatively trivial way from those that can be confirmed by observations. And while confirming this is very difficult because those worlds are not reachable even in principle, I think eternal inflation has many lines of observational support. And this, as far as I understand, is a fairly straightforward corollary. So therefore, we are forced to take this seriously. I'll argue from an unexpected line of thinking that there might be feedback into this. Please.
Yes, this
is a very very common view of this problem, generally a very common view of probability, and it stands like a paradox. The way I like to illustrate this is, and I think there is a world of difference, so to speak, between the infinite ensemble of actual island universes and a single instantiation of an infinite number of theoretical possibilities. I'm describing correctly what you said. Right? Okay. So I think there is a world of difference actually. The way I like it to illustrate it is an imagined example from most elementary probability possible. Suppose I'm flipping a fair coin, what is claimed to be a fair coin. And suppose I get 30 heads in a row. You're all sitting in this room and you're not flipping the coin. I'm the only one who is doing that. And to the best of my knowledge, people are busy with other things in the world than flipping coins. What is my interpretation of this event? Basically, my most likely interpretation of this event is that someone is cheating on me, that the coin is actually not fair. Now, think of a different experiment. Think I have the following information. That for the last 10,000 years, let's say, a billion inhabitants of the humans on the Earth have been spending all the time flipping coins. And now I get this result. Then my interpretation of this is that actually, if you do the very simple arithmetic, or simple elementary probability, The expectation is that at least once we will get 30 heads in a row. So my take on it is that probably I am the lucky one.
Throw 30 heads in a row with a coin, you should interpret that as being in this one multiverse where that happens to have happened. Right? It seems to me that that's what you're asking.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Mm. I'm actually wondering how this can be fortified. And the question is the following. Can we make a statement how many times life has evolved in how
we do it? Oh, we will come to that. We'll come to that. You know, I don't know whether we'll... I intend to come to that. Instead of, I'm sorry. yes, please.
Just for understanding, do I understand correctly that you substitute the probability, when we have no idea what probability space is, that ribosome happened to evolve by chance in our universe? The probability that we happen to be in one of the universes where ribosome exists.
Fair enough.
why is probability going to be equal to each other exactly? Because if entropic principle in a single universe is that, okay, I have something which is extremely unlikely, but conditional probability that this happens given my existence is one. So this is the same thing. It's very unlikely that we happen to be in one of the universes where ribosome exists. And
well, let me. This is the same paradox which I think is nevertheless resolved here. And if you want, I will address it in the following way. Suppose you have a single closed universe that has evolved from 13 billion years after a single Big Bang. We'll get to some toy calculations there. The probability of getting something as complex as the ribosome there is vanishingly small. And that is the probability for the entire universe in this model. This is what you have. You may claim entropically that nevertheless, this is what happened. Realistically, I would say we need to look for another solution. Say it again?
Gone. It's equivalent with predictive power is even stronger.
Yes and no. If you just say the word, perhaps. Try to give a reasonable definition of a god, I think you are getting in a huge problem. And I'll touch upon that as, not that exactly, but something similar. By dinner.
More interesting literature on this subject.
Oh, there is lots of interesting literature on there is lots of interesting as well as silly literature on the subject. Anyhow, let me just finish answering your question, nevertheless, you know. And then I would like to proceed a little bit after that, if that was possible at all. Now consider the multiverse situation. There actually, with some frequency, the emergence of something as complex as a translation system is inevitable. As a matter of fact, the probability of that happening in that situation is one. The frequency is another matter. These worlds are extremely rare.
I can't ask what is the question that we've got. You said somehow everything that is committed by the law of physics that happens in front of
you. Very good point.
However, you must not forget that the fundamental law of physics are physics themselves.
Some of them perhaps are not, but nevertheless. In a certain sense, yes. And for that matter, I'll argue that we are not really even trying to show that, say, the RNA world hypothesis is not feasible in principle. Within this worldview, actually, it is for sure. There are RNA worlds. What we are trying to figure out is what is the most likely history in our bubble. We have one instantiation of life, one and only that we are aware of, and it evolved in some particular way. So what we are trying to figure out is what is the most likely way it evolved. Okay. So basically, I think I already made this point regarding the multiverse. A system of any complexity that does not violate the physical laws is bound to exist in an infinite number of copies. So if you take a little step back and consider generally the early history of life, we'll immediately realize that, as a matter of fact, transition from chance and associated with it entropic selection to biological evolution is an absolutely inevitable thing. Because at the stage of the synthesis of monomers, or if we go deeper, formation of hospitable planets and so on and so forth, there could have been no biological selection. The fact that we exist in it by itself, of course, does not. Absolutely, it does not.
We don't know whether this universe arose through eternal inflation or some other route. You have to find out.
Well, that is absolutely true. As I tried to claim briefly, as I did, the eternal inflation model is a good way to account for a variety of important
things you can't understand yet.
For the variety of very specific observations, not for things that we cannot understand, but for a variety of specific observations, like the amplitude of the variation of CMB, like that, very specific things that are measured.
Another way to say it, there might be some other explanation that also accounts for these
facts. I am not claiming that this is the only possible one. It's very, very hard to prove. In some philosophical bend, it's impossible to prove. But I think even the possible has not been done yet.
So I think people would maybe think that if we all agree that biological evolution as we see today is not at odds with the laws of physics, or I guess most of us would agree. And that if,
let's all agree,
if you postulate that there is an infinity of multiverses where different macroscopic histories are played out, we also all agree that there are some where our particular history is going to be played out. The question that I guess we're all interested in is, and that nobody knows the answer to yet, is in what fraction of these would you actually get biological evolution and translation?
That's precisely the right question.
It's not really addressed, I think, by this theory. It still doesn't really say anything about the size of that fraction. It just says, if you know.
We will say if you. I think the number of free parameters here is too large to be very specific about the size of this fraction. But I will present some calculation toward the end if we survive that long. Okay, Andreas.
So somehow, polarity is not so much whether it's falsifiable or not, but that it shares an important feature with intelligent design.
Oh, I will come to that.
In the sense that it stops inquiry.
No, not in the least.
If you believe what you're saying, to me it seems like, we could all go home. At least those of us who are interested in
No. I will strongly argue specifically against intelligent design, not only that we should stay in the lab and continue working, but also that this worldview absolutely closes any loopholes for intelligent design, even if some of us sometimes thought that those might have existed. I don't believe it anyhow, but I think that this approach just closes the door to intelligent design.
The issue of falsifiability.
Yes.
The other main aspect of what people call science is that it has predictive qualities.
Absolutely.
And I don't see how the postulation of a multiverse here is at all useful in distinguishing between whether this difficult step in evolution was an RNA world versus some other.
Well, I think it's
I think it's
entirely critical for expanding this range in which we must envisage or model the transition, this transition from chance to biological evolution. That transition happened at some point beyond doubt. And that's what the point the replication evoked. I think the multiverse interpretation allows us to greatly expand the range. And yes, I will, yes.
So that's, I think, exactly the point. So I still don't see how the conditional probability, so the probability that a certain scenario happens given that we're here, is, I think, exactly equal in the multiverse and the single universe model. Because there are just more worlds that have a certain scenario, it's more likely given that the laws of physics that we have. So I think it gives you exactly the same conditional probability.
As a matter of fact, I think not. Considering the master universe or the, yeah, let's say master universe as a whole, everything that is, if you have a single Big Bang, you know, the classic model, everything that is your expanding universe. That's that. Whatever probability you get there is the probability that this level of complexity, this kind of arrangement, appeared by chance. Let me go. I think you got the idea. So let me go fairly quickly. Through the specific statements. And the probability of lunch at appropriate time is now, you know, dropping exponentially. But I'll try to be fast, and then we'll have to consider the condition, the dramatic transition from late lunch to early dinner. But let's see. So basically, what I suggest is a possible breakthrough system that is the one that is positioned at the threshold from chance to biological evolution is something considerably more complex than the RNA world, namely a primitive but functioning system of translation which includes the prototypes of the ribosome and the self-charging specific adapters, proto-tRNAs, so to speak, coexisting with RNA molecules capable of encoding, in the very least, one protein with the replicase activity to replicate those molecules. Very possibly also the prototypes of other protein folds that we consider unrelated. So this level of complexity, according to this model, would emerge by chance, and that would start biological evolution. Actually, I will not go through the details of this, but the translation system itself shows very clear signs of evolution by traditional pathways, by duplication, diversification. When we actually compare the sequences and structures of the key proteins of the translation system, we clearly see that they evolve by that path, as well as the tRNAs. And I just illustrate here the fairly striking observations from protein sequence analysis, if you think of them. This is a metaphor of the Big Bang protein evolution that we put there very prophetically before anything, any models like this were considered. In a certain sense, you could interpret it. Recalling the scheme that I showed, you could interpret it differently. But this is what entirely, fully the notion of the gamma of Big Bang. So in any case, the important thing here is that the specific amino acid tRNA synthetases, which, as I indicated in the beginning, are responsible for the functioning of the genetic code in modern systems, are just this little branching in the tree. So there was a lot of protein evolution, remarkably, even in this particular fold. This is just one large so-called... By all means.
Primitive version of
Yeah.
And then later, one of those.
Yes. Absolutely. What I'm saying is that you are absolutely right. Whatever the path of that evolution, the breakthrough translation system was much more primitive than the modern one. But remarkably, it was not much more sloppy. Fidelity was actually comparable to the modern ones, otherwise you would not get all this protein evolution.
Isn't Big Bang on this picture
synonymous with the boundary of our knowledge? Now, that is a deep question. In some ways, Big Bang, if we interpret it as a singularity, is always synonymous with the boundary of our knowledge. Yes, in a way, we really do not understand how proteins, if we to some extent understand the traditional evolution of proteins, we really do not understand how the evolution of protein folds started. So in a way, yes. And similar observations can be done with other proteins like translation factors. So basically, what would be the composition of the of this breakthrough system? Somewhat paradoxically, I warned you, but somewhat paradoxically, we are still claiming a very large role of RNA in the emergence of these breakthrough systems, but in a manner very different from the RNA, from the traditional RNA world. So I would claim that the likely composition of such a breakthrough system would be these RNA-only ribosomes, about 20, maybe a few less, but about 20 specific adapters, which would be ribosomes catalyzing self-charging and translatable RNAs. Actually, I think the same reasoning can be very well applied to the genetic code. It is not, in fact, necessary to believe that the observed robustness of the code emerged through a path of extensive evolution. Here I'm making a bit of a jump to my final lecture here on Friday and just showing you a somewhat bigger picture of where such breakthrough systems might have existed in a sort of the physical substrate for this evolution that we will discuss on Friday, that I believe is most plausibly imagined as a sort of system of inorganic compartments. Now, the RNA world alternative, as we already said, it's entirely imaginable. Moreover, we have to be coherent if we discuss that picture of the world and admit that such worlds exist. But what was the most likely breakthrough stage for evolution of life? Let's put it this way. What is the most likely breakthrough stage for the start of biological evolution? I'm not sure, given the problems that I outlined, that this is an RNA world with RNA-catalyzed replication and so on and so forth. I think that at least under this interpretation of the structure of the world, it is imaginable and perhaps more plausible that the breakthrough system was more complex, potentially as complex, as a coupled application translation system. So, consider the back end or maybe yes, maybe no. It's not quite that question. What I'm showing is actually a big difference. But you see, there is a difference. What we are talking here again is the transition from chance and whatever entropic selection is important for that, and biological evolution. We more or less know how biological evolution works. And I think we have big difficulties in deriving the translation system, let's say, from the RNA world by laws of biological evolution. Those laws we cannot violate. So the only thing that I'm suggesting is that the likely or at least possible breakthrough stage is actually much higher on the scale of complexity. So without going through this very, very much self-admittedly toy calculation, yes. I have almost finished actually to reach the end, and this is just a gross overestimate of what might have happened, assuming a huge number of life hospitable planets and so on. And the point here is that for something like RNA world, we could, in principle, with some strain, considerable strain, but in principle, we could imagine this happening in a single universe model, in a single Big Bang model. The probability of something like I described as a possible breakthrough system is really vanishingly small, and I think can be reasonably conceivable only under a kind of multiverse model that I tried to describe. So basically, down to here, roughly, one can think of the entire universe being the single observable region. After that, I think it goes into the infinite universe model. So there might be a feedback after all, I think. Horrible idea. Do we actually need any kind of biological evolution at all? Perhaps anything could evolve. Well, perhaps, but I think this is largely beside the point. Because as soon as we had the conditions for biological evolution, the process becomes effectively channeled. The number of possible trajectories becomes much smaller, and the accelerated process goes by the path of Darwinian evolution. So, he's back. Very much so. Now, another horrible idea that comes to me in my nightmares is that we actually propose the emergent by chance of something designed for a specific function, like translation. I think, however, that this is just a semantic trap. Outside the biological context where it functions, it's not a functional system. It's just something that is quite complex. Well, there are at least a couple of strong ways of falsification. One basically demonstrates, at least in a good simulation, at least in a good model, the feasibility of the RNA world, or best of all experimentally, but if not, some other way, or the feasibility of the RNA world and the emergence of translation. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that is too hard. Let's go out and discover independent life in a couple of locations in our galaxy. I even do not ask for the solar system. Even that, I think, will effectively falsify the scheme that I tried to present to you. The converse prediction, of course, is that any life forms that might be discovered, say, on Mars or Europa during NASA explorations, will have a common origin with Earth life. I fully expect that to happen. Now, in regard to intelligent design, now, that was a I did a little web experiment and found that intelligent design is mentioned on the web more than two orders of magnitude more frequently than inflationary cosmology, which is, I think, a curious observation. I also think that there is absolutely no free lunch for intelligent design here at all, because what we suggest is that considerable complexity that definitely would be sufficient for the start of biological evolution not only could, but did evolve by chance and anthropic selection. And this is it, and this is what I wanted to present. I think I will not read my conclusions. I have said enough. So basically, just to stop here. Again, this, I think, was the crux of the discussion here. I think it's very distinct from trivial anthropic reasoning. I'm sure there is dissent to that. That is, the world is sort of a Pangloss paradigm. The world is the way it is because otherwise we wouldn't be here. I think there is a big difference under a model that states that all histories are real. And the question is actually for us to try and understand which history is ours. Coming back to what Andre said, I think that we very much have to stay in the lab and in front of the computer trying to figure out what would be the minimal complexity required for the start of biological evolution. I would formulate the question on that, and we are trying to work on that. Okay, so just my acknowledgments, above all, to Alex Vilenkin, with whom we originator of many of these concepts, with whom we had lots of most inspiring discussions on the issue, as well as to several people who generously provided their time for discussion and participated in some of the specific studies. And the preliminary version can be found in the archive already. Thank you.